The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
Chris Waller is our guest now. He is Director of Research here at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. His specialty, no surprise, monetary theory, political economy, macroeconomics. He has known Jim Bullard for many years. He was actually a very young professor when Jim was in graduate school. Chris is still involved in many things, teaches at the Notre Dame. So as I said before the show, I've got to be very careful if I say anything about sports. I'll refrain.
Well, we have the women are in the Final Four.
That's right.
We're rooting away for
there
that.
There you go. Well, let's get right to the St. Louis Fed. And I love the story about you tell when Jim first came to was Indiana State University.
Indiana University.
Well, anyway, Wright State. And how he was, even then, he's a kind of a quiet guy, very thoughtful. But even then, he was a bit of a standout. You guys really seem to have bonded because here you are, 25 years later, still working together.
Yeah, no, Jim was a grad student in just kind of a brown bag seminar. And I hadn't met him. And he just came in and just had all these questions. And several of the faculty said, I'm like, who is this guy? Several of us hadn't met him. And through that period when he was in graduate school, he and I actually became friends. And then later on, going to conferences, working in similar areas, I came here and spent a year as a visitor in 94, 95. And then, you know, just over the years, we talked a lot about the bank and some things that were going on at Washington University here in St. Louis and how we could build up a relationship there as well. And then when Jim was named president, he asked me to come do this. And I probably wouldn't have done it for too many other people, but for Jim, I did it.
Well, so talk to us a little bit then about how this thinking and research and position is developed here, because Steve Matthews and Vonnie and I, back in our New York studio, were just talking about how Jim presaged. He was the one when Steve and I were here in October 2009 quantitative easing had only begun. And Jim said, well, you know, we don't know how long we're going to do this. If we're going to keep doing this, we need to sort of, you know, establish the parameters. We need to think how we're doing it here, you know. And then Ben Bernanke, just in the last couple of weeks, formalized that this is where the Fed is now. This is the new policy instrument, bond purchases versus Fed funds rate. And Jim was talking about it years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, the St. Louis Fed has had a long tradition of leadership in monetary policy, largely part based on academic style research, going back to Homer Jones. I mean, Homer was the one who really started this tradition in St. Louis, and that's, you know, why we honor him today with this lecture. But it continued on particularly through the 70s, 60s and 70s, when the St. Louis Fed was known for a monetarist approach, a very anti-inflation approach, whereas other parts of the Fed system were much more Keynesian. And I think at the end of the day, by the late 70s, it was clear that St. Louis had won that argument, and the policies they adopted were the ones that had to be done and led to the end of the great inflation. The old Keynesian monetarist debate has kind of faded away, but it doesn't mean that you still don't have this kind of leadership in the process. So Jim's actually had several of these things that are a bit on the outside at first. People don't kind of agree with it, which is kind of the tradition in St. Louis. And the state contingent quantitative easing was the first one, which was, we don't do interest rate policy this way. We adjust interest rates as the economy changes. We shouldn't be doing QE where we fix a number and march off a cliff and end it at a certain point. You'd never do interest rates that way. So that was that took, as he jokes, that took him 3 years to get everybody to come around to that. But eventually he won the battle on that. The other big thing was his leadership in pointing out when we were headed for deflation in 2010, right, that one of his lines to me was always, we're headed for Japan like a freight train.
Oh, gosh.
So if there's one thing QE should be able to do is change inflation, right, and inflation expectations. We can argue about the quantitative effects.
Chris, can I ask you if there was much reaction around the St. Louis Federal Reserve building to a piece that appeared in the New York Times at the weekend, David Stockman's piece, which does seem to have reignited this debate that the St. Louis Fed would definitely be participating in?
Yeah, I mean, St. Louis has always been, and we are, we're very, I will say, we're on the inflation hawk side. But in terms of the QE, there's my own research and others have shown that you can inject this amount of cash into the system, and as long as you can credibly commit to withdraw it, you won't get any inflation. You won't have an explosion of inflation. The problem is if you put it in and say, we're never taking it out, and in fact, we're going to continue to let it grow forever, that's when you have a problem. So I've always interpreted the fact that we haven't seen a lot of inflation despite the size of QE is a reflection of the commitment and credibility that the Fed has with the markets. And you can see this in tip spreads and many, many other things. If the market ever comes to believe that we will not do this, that's when we run the risk of having these kind of inflation.
But isn't there definitely a big swath of opinion out there that says, well, you won't be able to do that?
Yep. We hear it all the time. And the question is, do we have the tools and the will to do it? We certainly have the tools to do it. That's not an issue. And the bigger question is the speed of getting our balance sheet back to normal, I think, is really the question people argue about, is can you get it down fast enough if the situation arises? Now, monetary policy in general has always been much quicker at being able to respond to things than, say, fiscal policy, for example. That's one of the hallmarks of an independent central bank. So I strongly believe we can do it.
Okay.
Other people clearly don't.
Credibility, Europe. That's from in many corners, that credibility is shredded, and particularly after Cyprus's quote unquote bailout, bail in, whatever you want to call it, was mishandled. What's your sense of where Europe is now and it, you know, what Cyprus did to the ball? Move it up the field, down the field? What?
Yeah, I think, I think the problem with the EU is they can't seem to come up with a consistent strategy for dealing with these things. Everything seems to be a one-off strategy. Well, Greece is special. Spain is special. Italy is special. Now Cyprus is special. And that was exactly the words that came out of leaders' mouths, that, oh, Cyprus was just special. Until they come up with a consistent strategy for dealing with these problems, they're not going to get any credibility on how this thing's going to be resolved. And then when they throw out, in my personal opinion, kind of very drastic plans like making insured depositors taking haircuts, which if that's now a policy option, that'll scare everybody in Europe, and rightfully so. So this is not helping their I believe their credibility in trying to deal with this crisis, and why it just continues to just drag on and on and on.
Do you believe that it's possible to have a union of sovereigns?
You mean a
monetary
fiscal union?
A monetary, like an EMU, basically.
Oh, do I think the EMU can survive? Yes, I think it did. I think this is not an issue about whether the EMU can survive. You may argue whether it'll be 15 nations or 16 nations as opposed to, say, 10 or 12, but I think the EMU itself will survive. We haven't seen Greece. We haven't seen anybody say they want to leave, really seriously leave the euro, because I think people think it's a panacea for solving problems that it really isn't. Because as soon as you say you're leaving the euro, you know what they're going to do. They're going to create a hyperinflation. That doesn't solve anybody's
problems.
How
are they going to withstand? One calculation I saw was if Greece stays in the eurozone the way things are right now, it will take them, two decades or many years to dig out of the hole they're in. Now, come on. How is any country going to stay in such a deep hole for so long and withstand it? The Italians have rejected austerity. Where are they going?
Yeah, well, in some sense, the markets ultimately will discipline you in that sense if the ECB doesn't continue keeping the pipeline open. I used to go to Ukraine a lot. Very fiscally sound country. They had ran a balanced budget every year, not because they wanted to. The markets wouldn't lend them a penny. So this is where you're headed, and it's the thing is wages and prices have to adjust, and you can either adjust them by trying to deflate it away, printing your own currency, or they can just fall by market forces. There's nothing that says they can't go down over time. That's just what competitive pressure does to prices and wages. It's just they don't want to do that. That's more the problem. So a lot of these things are, it's not that they can't do it, they just don't want to do it.
Well, Chris, well, it's great to have you back on the show. We're not going to wait another year to have you back. I want to continue this conversation on Europe and more. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Kathleen.
You can listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at 12:30 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013, Bloomberg LP.